Roguecast is the official podcast of Rogues Gallery Comics and Games. Every week we talk about new comic releases, store news, and whatever games, movies, and TV is on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
This is Dave.
I'm Nick.
And now, on with the show.
Welcome to Roguecast episode 224.
The Great 224.
The Great 224. Any issue numbers, Dave? Anything, any...
Past the X-Men era, I feel like X-Men and Spider-Man were my comics from those times, but other than 224 being like, I think, what, early on in either Roger Stern's run?
Let's see, Avengers 224, that would be a Scott Lang story. It's actually maybe like the first appearance of Scott Lang and the Yellow Jacket story.
Okay.
It's a flashback of the introduction of Scott Lang, and also Yellow Jacket's on the cover in prison.
Does it say what year it was?
It says it was October.
Okay.
It's a Jim Shooter story, actually.
You know, I was just telling one of our staffers the other day about Shooter, and he was, he kind of ruled with an iron fist, and was, by all accounts, like, a pain in the ass to work under.
Yep, yep.
But he also presided over some of the most fertile times for Marvel's creativity.
Right.
So it's just one of those things. Sometimes people under duress work well. I think probably also it was just... You know, that we were getting to that generation that were like the next wave of, you know, matured talents after the kind of the first Bronze Age guys.
Sure.
And I think a lot of talent was just hitting at the same time. But it's only Spider-Man number 220, Amazing Spider-Man number 224 was a Vulture story. Absolutely a comic I got as a kid. I believe that's the one where in it Spidey's Aunt May was dating that who was that guy older dude she dated from the retirement home.
Oh, Nathan Lubensky.
Yeah, and he actually like recognized at the retirement home or something like that. Abe Toombs, is that the Vulture?
Yep, Adrian Toombs.
Adrian Toombs, that's right. He like recognizes him at some point, I remember he was. He's after a guy at a robotics show who I think had like stolen some of his wing technology and had kind of become the next Bill Gates or whatever, basically on his Vulture technology, and he was trashing it. It was a good premise. Roger Stern writing, John Romita Jr. on art. Good issue. I'm gonna say that sets the tone for today's podcast. Today's podcast is Vulture themed.
Yes. further confused, 224 is also February 24th, and on February 24th in. in 1977, boxer Floyd Mayweather Jr. was born. So today's theme is Floyd Mayweather Jr.
Yes,
Vultures and Yellow Jackets.
Right. I need to make sure I don't accidentally start talking about Floyd Mayweather and not Mayweather Jr.
Yes. Yeah. That's right. Exactly right. So yeah, that was a bit of a diversion.
We'll edit that out in post production.
I have no favorite 224 comics.
Oh, okay.
There's the X-Men one. I was flipping through it, and I'm like, I think I remember that this was a Fall of the Mutants lead-in, I believe, with like Longshot and Havoc being someone running over Havoc on the cover. And I know I've read it.
Yeah, I remember this.
But
that's an ignominious way for a superhero to die, is to just get run over.
Well, I mean, Banshee got run over by a plane.
What happened,
I guess,
to Chip? Chip got run over by a space truck on Mosaic.
Yeah, that's true.
It happens more than you think.
Yeah,
some heroes get hit by cars and planes and die that way.
Yeah, it happens.
And of course, we all remember Banshee's great death when the plane hit him.
Yeah. So yeah. Anyway, news. Store news specifically. We have our Star Wars X-Wing 2nd Edition demo is coming up this Saturday. People seem pretty hyped for that.
Yeah, totally. I've had several people expressing interest. We're going to have like a kit where people can play the new edition.
So what we have is the preview copy. We have that now, so anyone can come in and take a look at it all they want.
And several people have.
We have a preview copy of the new two-player starter, all those rules, all that. We also have conversion kits for all three factions, which come with a ton of different... new maneuver dials and cards, that kind of thing. So if people have the old stuff and they want to bring their ships in and say, well, how does this stuff work? Bring your ships. Try it out. Specifically, We don't have a person specifically running this demo for us, just like an X-Wing expert.
Right.
Our staffer, Honor, who has played X-Wing, is going to bone up on the rules and try to help out.
Yep. But she's been playing it, like, a lot lately.
But this is more of a come-out-and-play kind of demo, as opposed to we're going to teach you how to play the game kind of demo.
Right.
And then the whole thing will release next week.
You know, it's kind of cool. Honor, is it her cousin? Her
uncle, I believe.
Uncle, yes. They have been, he's been printing out 3D printer stuff, yep. Of, like, essentially that holds the little pieces and cards and stuff like that for a given turn. It, like, expand. You know, it's just, like, his own production, I think, or maybe it's stuff that they found online. I don't know.
No, he's actually
I was under the impression
it.
He was doing it, yeah. But the sides of it have, like, little, sort of those little jigsaw puzzle interlinks so that they can expand it for larger hands and stuff. And it was pretty cool.
It is cool.
I feel like they should probably put that out there on what are those sites that sell
Etsy
the specifically Randy sells like boxes and stuff for board game kit
Broken
pieces.
Token?
Yeah, probably something like that.
They make their own. I mean, they're not like a fan site. They make their own stuff.
Okay.
Etsy would be the place.
Those guys. Then.
Etsy would be the place.
Yeah, sure.
Also, this weekend is Staple. The Small Press Expo, that is going to be down in East Austin. We are sponsors, as always, as have been for many, many years. I will be there on Saturday, and I'm sure we'll have some staffers wandering around on Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
Go out, check it out, buy some stuff from local
creators.
Who are
some of the big guests? I know...
I mean, I don't have it in front of me. Nick, why you put me on the spot?
Oh, okay. Well, I know that Colleen Coover is coming out.
Colleen Coover is coming in. Evan Narcisse, who wrote the Rise of the Black Panther comic, is going to be there.
Right.
I think he's an Austin guy. There's a few other people.
And many, many more.
And many, many more.
Yes.
Go look at Staples' website. What do I know?
Yeah, Nick. Maybe you should tell us. You seem to know so much.
Sure. I mean, we all have these handy computers and cell phones in front of us.
The website is staple-austin.org.
Yes.
It's always a fun event, though. Yes. People should definitely check it out.
And you get away from that super crazy hustle and bustle of, like mega conventions.
Yep.
And the impersonal nature of waiting in line for 3 hours just for somebody to quick sign something, shake your hand, and move you on.
It's a good place to get crafted stuff and mini comics and prints. And
people have all kinds of cool weird things too, sculpted things and stuff. Little things that are probably going to turn out to be haunted when you buy them. All kinds of neat stuff.
Wow.
What? I mean it in a cool way. That doesn't sound bad to me.
Then next weekend we have Batman Day on Saturday, December 15th, where we'll have free comics and a sale and all that kind of stuff. And then our final D&D 101, at least for a while, Sunday, September 16th. Still space in that.
Yep.
That next following Saturday, September 22nd, we've got the Starfinder Munchkin launch. You can come out, try out Starfinder Munchkin, possibly win a copy of the expansion, get some free bookmarks and promo cards. And the weekend after that is the Guilds of Ravnica pre-release. That's on Saturday, September 29th, running at 5 o'clock. Mm-hmm. And then Sunday, September 30th, we'll have two of them running basically all day. And then that's also Georgetown Library, or Pflugerville Library's Comic-Con. No, it's Georgetown Library. I don't know, whatever it is. We'll have more info on that. I'll be out there on that Saturday. Yep. So I'm going to do a lot of stuff this week.
A lot of stuff.
Yeah.
Don't forget to take a nap somewhere in there.
Sure. I'm going to do it right now.
And probably grab some snacks.
All right. Not a ton of actual news this week. A couple notable other media bits. Henry Cavill has been cast to headline The Witcher on Netflix. He's going to play, I guess, The Witcher.
Has anybody here played The Witcher games?
No.
Is anybody here a Witcher themselves?
No.
Is Witcher a thing that is in the game?
The only way you can determine who a Witcher is if you have to dunk them in water, and if they drown, they are not a Witcher.
Yeah.
However... That being said, it is an insanely popular
right, it's supposed
property.
To be a super badass fantasy game series that everybody who's cool that I know who plays video games likes.
Yeah, well, and they're doing the Cyberpunk game. The studio that did Witcher is doing the Cyberpunk game. So.
Oh, I did not know that.
So I want to play Witcher, I just don't have time for it.
And also, I just like Henry Cavill.
Yeah.
And I think he'll have some fun with this property, and they'll be able to do it right.
Does Cavill do exclusively genre projects these days?
Pretty much, yeah. Here's the other thing, is like, he's a big movie star. Like, he played Superman in the DC movies. He was in Mission Impossible. Like he's coming to TV is kind of a big deal.
Yep. I think he must kind of be enjoying these action roles.
Yeah.
And being able to be the star in, like, something based on a mega hit video game series does sound pretty cool. Hopefully it will be good, because as we know, all video game TV shows and movies stink.
They all suck, yeah.
Have there been many video game TV shows, though?
Maybe, I don't know.
I can't really think of one off the top. This might be the...
Castlevania, the animated one, but it's sort of like a live
And that actually, I guess, would be an exception, since that's supposed to be pretty decent.
Solid.
This could be the birth of something.
I mean, there's always been video game cartoons. I watched a Pole Position cartoon as a kid. It was the worst thing I'd ever seen in my life. But I still had to watch it because it was Pole Position.
Cartoons are completely different. I mean, Sonic, that ran forever.
Yeah, and some, I'm sure the Mario Brothers...
Mario Brothers cartoon, that existed, and I think I watched a couple episodes.
Probably Donkey Kong probably has one.
Donkey Kong had one. Yeah. What do you call it? Pac-Man had one back in the 80s.
Oh my god, there was a Q-Bert cartoon.
There was a Q-Bert cartoon.
Yeah.
But like live action video game
I'm trying to think
TV
of any.
Series?
I can't think of one.
This might be the birth.
The
closest I can think of is the Tia Carrere thing, which was loosely based on sort of Tomb Raider. What was she like?
Fortune Hunter.
Fortune Hunter, yes.
Okay, well, I guess like the online Mortal Kombat thing, right? That had like a mini-sodes, right?
Yeah, so yeah.
Web series.
That doesn't really count.
But it did have its moments, so...
I feel like Netflix might put more money into it than...
Right. If there's anybody who maybe got a shot at it, Netflix did the Castlevania thing, which was good,
I'm just saying, Randy, if this goes well, maybe Netflix will put some money and do an Overwatch live action.
Yes, that'd be nice. Or an anime one.
I don't care. Just give us that.
Finally, we want to mention the news that the next Die Hard movie, Die Hard 6?
It's Die Hard 6. I try to pretend Die Hard 5 didn't happen.
I pretend nothing past Die Hard 3 happened.
Die Hard 3 is my cutoff, too.
Live Free, Die Hard was fun. I don't care what you two...
Your objection is noted, Nick, for the record. You know what I think they should start doing when you get into long franchises is go ahead and start linking them up in a shared universe. So, like, get Rocky in there, you know?
Mission Impossible 6 just hit, so Mission Impossible Die Hard 6.
Yeah. Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. I don't see why not. What if Rocky Balboa could come in and train John McClane to back into fighting shape?
So that he can join the Impossible Missions Force.
Right, and they can bring in Creed, too, as a crossover
And then they can take down those hooligans of Dom's crew.
Yes. Just think about it. Just bear me out, Hollywood.
It's no less ridiculous than anything else.
Kids are used to all the mashups in the Lego games and in their crazy fanfic worlds.
Anyway, Die Hard 6 is going to be called McClane. Just like Logan.
And so the premise that y'all were saying earlier, I kind of like. So that remind me...
Basically, it's going to be split. I don't know how, like, 60-40, whatever, but it's going to be young McClane, I guess, as a beat cop or something. Probably. And an older John McClane. So I don't know if it's going to be like a... I remember back in the day.
Right, or it could be a case that's come back to haunt him.
Yeah.
Either way, I think it's kind of clever to do because... If young McClane, if the actor they pick works out in this, by chance this ends up being a halfway decent movie, then they've got sort of new blood in the Die Hard franchise, and it doesn't have to be Bruce Willis's blood.
You know what they should do?
Yeah?
I'm half joking.
Young John McClane versus young Hans Gruber.
What I was going to say is you should actually show young Hans Gruber, and then the thing that comes back to haunt him should be Hans Gruber's son out for revenge on old McClane.
No.
Well, they already had his...
Hans' brother.
That's why you got to do his son. His brother's already dead. Or his nephew. Because his nephew would be a guy, it's like, you killed my uncle, and then you killed my dad. And now I'm going to kill you.
No, no, if you're going to go crazy, you have it be the son of the long blonde-haired...
That guy is the surprise ally. He shows up, and old McClane is like, I guess you want revenge for your pops. He's like, no, my pops was a terrible man. I've come to help you against my friend.
These all sound like great ideas. I will say, by the way, the cross allegiances of family and stuff like that is straight out of Rocky. Rocky had a whole bunch of that between teaming up with Apollo Creed and then the vendetta with Ivan Drago and stuff like that. Right. Which is why the crossover is going to make so much sense.
Right, right, and also you know where else family is kind of important.
Yeah,
maybe
at Olive Garden.
Maybe Al will show
but
back
I believe
up.
You were talking about the Fast Five.
I wasn't talking about the Fast and Furious movies, yes.
Maybe Al will show back up in 6.
And then, who, what?
The cop, Al.
The cop.
Al, yeah.
I heard Owl.
Me too.
And yeah. I was like...
the Owl.
Yes.
Dave's favorite villain. will show up.
It's a weird crossover.
Actually, I was thinking that John McClane had a hunting owl that, you know, that he would use. I'm a falconer now.
Welcome to the Peregrine, pal.
Strike my pretties.
And Die Hard 6 took a very interesting turn.
Still better than Die Hard 5.
He's become a radical anti-gun activist, and he only fights with Peregrine Falcons.
All right, we'll be back. You got more?
No, I was just going to say the actual premise of the movie sounds all right. I do wonder, you know, he's already been played. We've already had a young Bruce Willis character written. Nick, you were talking about earlier. Who played him in Looper?
Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
Did a good job.
Yeah.
I don't think they're probably going to use him again. But no, it is interesting that he will have he will begin having a history of films in which there is somebody who portrays a younger version of him.
That makes sense.
But I got to say, premise-wise, I'm not going to completely assume that I wouldn't watch this because I've skipped the last two. I don't feel any regrets for skipping them.
Yep.
You should watch Live Free or Die Hard.
No, you shouldn't.
Your objection is noted, Nick, in the files.
Listeners, come to my defense. Somebody else out there has to like it as much as I do.
Sure, sure. That kid from the Apple kid?
Yeah, the Apple kid.
Yeah, maybe he could ride in.
He loves it.
I will say Kevin Smith's involvement lessens it a little bit.
He's in it?
He's in it. He plays a hacker.
Yeah.
This is me looking at Nick with squinted eyes, like Fry from Futurama. I can't tell if joking or just insane.
Oh, I thought you were doing Shut Up and Take My Money.
No, different Fry. Anyway, I'm just saying, it is interesting to me that they have managed to come up with a premise where I'm at least open to it.
Yeah, I agree. Same
all
here. Right,
that's all I got.
All right, we'll be back in a second to talk about comics for the week. One familiar cry. We were talking comics week of Wednesday, September 5th, and it's first week.
Yes.
A lot of comics.
Right. Last week was a weird week.
Yeah.
Still some good stuff, but this is a more bountiful week of total overall.
What's a little strangest thing for all of us? It wasn't like a super bountiful week. Like, we had a little trouble finding stuff. Like, none of our favorites came out this week. It was all sort of newer stuff. There's a lot of new possibilities this week, is what I would say.
Yes.
Yeah, I had several number ones I liked. There's a few regulars that for me as well.
And anyway... scan the wall when you come in this week because there's a bunch of stuff and it's a bunch of new stuff.
Yes.
So Dave, why don't you kick us off?
Sure. My pick is Elric the White Wolf from Titan Comics. I have to say, you know, Titan Comics is British comics company. What else have they been making? They made like
Doctor Who.
They made the Warhammer 40K stuff.
Yeah.
They usually have what I'm going to say is passable artists, sometimes solid. But guys, flip see what I'm looking at here in this Elric stuff. Yeah. This is like painted art that is on the order of like Kerry Nord's Conan or something that. I mean, that's a big leap, but it is absolutely that level of craftsmanship. Even if I don't prefer it as
Prince
much.
Prince Valiant style.
Yeah. It's very elaborate and has this like very rich color scheme that look kind of I'm going to say Game of Thrones-ish. It has It has the Winter is Coming look. Anyway, Elric, for those that don't know, is one of those kind of the dark heroes of fantasy, kind of another one of those before George Martin came around. He was like an alternative to Tolkien's kind of relative up-tempo stories and heroic stories. Michael Moorcock's stories were downbeat. They kind of, I think, they popularized the idea of chaos as a force for destruction.
Do you want to be depressed?
It is kind of that. Elric himself is this, like, albino prince. He's a sorcerer and a warrior, but he's also, like, sickly and dying. His sword, Stormbringer, drinks souls, but, like, and is always thirsty for more, so he has to kind of rein it in. And there's this sense of doom that hangs over everything in an almost Lovecraftian way. The chaos of that world is like has a Lovecraftian vibe to it. That I think, like, when D&D has Lovecraftian elements in it, and I can't remember if the order in chaos stuff is straight out of Elric. I think it might be like that. Those as warring forces.
Yeah.
I think that was very much an element in there.
Didn't some comic book company? Like, there's been, about, like, 5 years ago, didn't they do an Elric comic? Was like, Chris Roberson wrote it?
Everyone has done Elric comics.
Okay. Yeah. Right. I was talking about this with Randy off mic earlier and saying, I've actually enjoyed most of the ones I've read, and yet I've never read an Elric novel. But I've read adaptations of them, and I've read comics that spin out of them. So P. Craig Russell has done several adaptations. Yeah. Walt Simonson did some stuff, maybe for DC, that was, I think, an originals like story, kind of a, here's a lost story in Ulrich's world. So a lot of the people I like have worked on it. I don't know any of these people who are working on it, but they did a really good job. It's Julian Blondel and Jean-Luc Queneau writing it, with art by Julian Tello and Robin Recht. I did not even notice that there were two different artists
on
it.
You made up all those names.
Maybe there was maybe it's flashback stuff. Anyway, this recaps two of the previous novels, so this is another one of those where I always just jump in on these. Like, I don't have a great sense of the bigger picture, but in this, Ulrich is kind of in exile. It seems like the woman he loves, in trying to rescue her, he may have, done something that might have gotten hundreds or even thousands killed, and she's a little distraught over it. And so he's kind of off on his own. He's traveling around, and while he's traveling, there's some of the stuff I liked right out of the gate was that Stormbringer is like talking to him, like in his mind, I guess. And when these bandits kind of come after him, and the sword is like, come on, you know that I need the souls, and that it'll strengthen you. Kill them using me, and so he's having to kind of fight with his sword for the whole time.
Like a weird vampiric sword.
Yeah, I'm imagining it sort of in a whiny voice. Come on, kill him already.
You probably could read it that way.
I'm hungry.
I need their souls.
you actually, as I'm looking through this, you could totally read it that way if you wanted to ruin it.
I do.
Along the way, he ends up hooking up with... No, I'm not saying hooking up with... He befriends a guy who's kind of a crusty, likable sailor guy. They end up kind of working side by side. And he finds himself summoned by this sort of... this spectral vision of a wolf to a nearby city where basically this queen who seems like he's got some... kind of got some interest in romantically... She wants to kind of... She knows who he is. There's some, for sure, Game of Thrones stuff happening with, like, his brother is on the throne, and she's having issues with him. She recognizes that he can't come in and help defend him, defend her kingdom against his crap-ass brother. But she does seem to... There's, like, big things do happen in this. She wants him to go to this, like, magical gate to try and find it, use his sorcerer-type powers to open it. It seems to be a place where you can go and, like, escape even, like, kind of the eye of the gods in it. So the ideas in this are very big ideas, but they're all dark and depressing. And I have to say, sometimes I like that. This feels more... This is, I think, for people who like Game of Thrones... But there is like a sense of doomed hero that kind of hangs over all of it. At the same time, there's moments of camaraderie and sort of humanity for him, and I like the sort of the balance and the alchemy of it. It also looks stunningly designed. I think these look to all be European artists, and like when I look at like the armor that they have on some of the some of the warriors and stuff in this, it looks as designed as anything on Game of Thrones. Like something where this was not just I need some scary warriors in this. This is I am going to have somebody who works up designs well before the comic comes out.
I mean,
out.
It reminds me a lot of some of the designers of Pathfinder. Kind of that intricately detailed and armored.
Oh, you know what else I would mention that reminds me in a roundabout way of the Seven to Eternity comic?
Yeah.
I think this shares thematic style with that.
Depressing.
Yes. I'm going to start a little section of the store that's like Dave's depressing fantasy comics, and these two are going to be my starter kit.
Those are like the crown jewels.
Obviously, anybody who's read Ulrich stuff, I'd recommend checking it out, and I'd be interested to know what you think about it, whether this seems like a faithful adaptation. What I'm looking at makes it feel pretty faithful to me, but I've never read the books, and I don't know. But that is my pick. It's called Ulrich the White Wolf. And I assume it's a mini-series meant to adapt the book.
It is an ongoing series with less than 100 issues.
Randy says an ongoing series.
Of course, you should keep in mind.
He seems to know everything about Ulrich.
Everything I know about Ulrich, I think I've learned from reading the first page of 100 different comics.
Yes.
I'll put my money on it being a 6-issue miniseries.
Sounds right.
Nick is probably closer to Great Warhead. My pick is a new Vertigo book called Border Town. It is written by Eric M. Esquivel. Art is by Ramon Villalobos and colorist Tamara Bonvillon. And It is about Devil's Fork, Arizona, which the first caption informs me is on the border between Mexico and the United States of America. Starts off with a sort of pro-American militia type, a Mexican family making their way across the border, and a monster killing all of them.
Yes.
And then...
And a interesting monster, too. Not just any monster, but a monster that is seems to clearly be out of some kind of Mexican folklore. Yep.
And then we jump to the next day, and we're seeing this kid move into Devil's Fork, which is, you know, one of these...
It's like a small town, right?
It's small townish. It reminds me of all those movies in the 80s where some kid would move to a small... To
like
a,
the Karate Kid?
To a town in California, yes.
Yep.
It is like the Karate Kid.
Boys.
The Karate Kid on the border.
And then he, you know, he falls in with one crowd and the other. And meanwhile, there are all these weird monsters coming through it. And the basic concept here is that the border between America and Mexico is also the border between our world and the world of, like, Mexican folklore, the Aztec underworld.
Right.
So this is going to be like a
racially tinged kind of...
Buffy.
Yeah. And it is about those high school kids. They're the primary characters. Yeah.
And there's also Chupacabra, who will apparently be joining them.
There's Chupacabra. There's there's a skinhead jerk in there.
So, anyway, the thing I like about this, the art is really good. It reminds me of Frank Quitely a little bit.
Yeah. I thought the art was fantastic on it.
It's really, really good. The moment-to-moment stuff I really like. However, there are a couple things. There's one bit where the kid jumps up and yells, "Oh, and I'm half Mexican!" And papers are flying. Everyone's looking at him. And then people just go back about their business. And I'm like, that was weird.
Yeah, we occasionally get that. I don't know where this writer came from, but I do remember...
Outside of comics, probably.
When we were when we were seeing the new Vertigo stuff coming up, a lot of their premises sounded good. But I noticed a lot of writers, there was writers from like, oh, he's a, you know, a somebody who's a playwright, or he's a novelist, or he's a filmmaker, or whatever. And sometimes when those guys come in, they have a little bit of trouble adapting to the idiom of comics.
Yeah, there's a little bit of...
A little tropiness?
A little tropiness. Yeah, Dan and I were talking about how, like, there's always the new kid comes to the new school and has to deal with bullying and finding his clique and all that. And yes, that happens, but...
Yeah, people will walk up and say, "Hey, new kid," you know, or they'll, like, "I heard you're the new kid." Yeah. There seems to be a lot of talk about you. And I'm like,
That has never happened to me ever.
Never
when
really
I was
remember, like, yeah, unless there was something like, "Oh, yeah, I heard he killed someone," or, you know, "This guy's just got out of juvie," or something like that. Nobody cared really about new kids. Yeah. They were mostly kind of shunned.
Unless they're new kids on the block.
Yes. But I also, I like Border Town quite a bit, too. I like the premise and the kind of motley crew of kids that assemble. I like
their characters.
I feel the art. Like, you know, it's sort of South of the Border Stranger Things vibe is also a little bit there.
I'm curious to see where they go from here.
Yeah, totally. It's one that I wanna keep checking out, and that art in particular is noteworthy.
Yeah. Nick, what's your pick this week?
I am going to pick Avengers number 7, which is all about the first Ghost Rider.
This is let me quick ask, Nick, because I read this issue and I hadn't been reading Avengers much for the other ones. This is like the origin story in like that sort of for the Ghost Rider 1 million, 1 million BC, I mean.
The 1 million BC.
And it looks like, have they been doing other ones featuring the other characters?
This is actually the first one. I mean, they've mentioned a few of them a couple of issues back, but it's not sort of like an ongoing. I think they might be like doing the long, like what Jason Aaron has done with Thor. Yep. He's sort of doing the long story.
Yeah,
and
okay.
After a story arc, he'll throw one of these in as a sort of interstitial.
Gotcha. That makes sense.
Focusing on one. Because, I mean, we all sort of know about Odin. We all sort of know about the Phoenix.
Right.
But we don't know about, like, the first Black Panther and the first Ghost Rider.
Right. And how on earth can you have a Ghost Rider in an era before vehicles? It doesn't make any sense. What would they do with him?
Well, he rides a Mastodon.
He does.
Which is pretty awesome.
It is pretty.
Actually.
Does the Mastodon catch fire every time? Does it need a new Mastodon every time?
Nah, it seems to be chilling on the Hellfire.
Okay.
Yeah, he likes
it. It just becomes metal as hell.
Okay.
Now, I will say, this does, I thought would really appeal to Dave because it's about cavemen.
Yep.
And sort of...
It did appeal. It's actually only some of Jason Aaron's slightly larger than life things is not what I kind of wanted. Like, I felt like there's a few slightly different things, ways this could have gone that I would have liked so much better. But it starts out cool. There's this guy who's like an above average kind of intelligence caveman kind of guy?
Yeah, he's basically the most intelligent member of his tribe, and he tries to hide it because he doesn't want to be cast out. Mm-hmm. So he sort of is trying to live the life and communicate non-verbally, but mm-hmm. even though he can actually speak, until one day a mysterious stranger appears and sort of takes over his tribe.
Right.
And then subsequent bad things as well, which leads him out into the cold to sort of try to find his way, which I actually thought the mysterious stranger ties into like Marvel mythology in a very cool way. I like it as sort of an adversary to pit the first Ghost Rider against.
Right. This is, people will ultimately know this to be a known Marvel antagonist.
Oh, yeah.
There's another known antagonist who appears in a unusual form.
Yep.
But I don't want to say what it is because the form I think could give away.
Yes. It's all beautifully rendered by Sarah Pacelli.
Mm-hmm.
She's just a
fantastic there's these kind of
artist.
Icy Arctic northern you know coloring. And I know she's not necessarily doing the color, but you know it's that kind of combination
she
of
is.
Like oh is she?
She's she has a hand in it too.
There's a combination of these sort of like the
oh no, it's Justin Ponzer who does the color art.
Yeah, Sarah Pacelli can't color for crap.
Wow.
I was going to say it's this mixture of kind of the warm hues of like, you know, campfires and stuff around for like these ice age dwellers.
And her rendering of the Mastodon is amazing.
I liked it at some point. There was one or two pages where I was like, it was almost cute. And I needed it
what
to be more
metal. What
do you
say, that mastodons can't be cute?
I needed to, like, you know how in D&D, how they have dire animals where, like, bone
you
spurs...
You want a dire mastodon?
Sprout from them, and they have, like, a crown of, like, horns on their head and stuff like that. I want him to become a little bit more like that.
But it's supposed to be Ghost Rider's friend.
That's true. But it's demonic-powered.
Anyway. It is supposed to be demonic-powered, but...
Anyway, but before the end of it, you do see this prehistoric Ghost Rider rumble.
Yes. And there's also the invention of Ghost Rider's chain, which I thought was pretty cool.
Yep.
And just more tying into sort of the larger first Avengers of 1 million BC.
Right.
I really like what Aaron is doing with the Avengers story. I kind of fell off the main book a little bit. The Celestial stuff, sometimes I need to read in large chunks because I forget things.
Yep.
But I really liked this as sort of a one-shot, giving me the background of the character.
Yeah, yeah. Weirdly, it's one that people could kind of come in on even if they hadn't been reading things.
Yeah, I agree.
Because if you just like Ghost Rider or just thought this looked like a cool issue.
Backup pick is a stalwart for me. It is Batman number 54. This is sort of a kind of a tribute issue. It's Tom King is writing it, but it's a different artist than we've seen before on his Batman series, and that's Matt Wagner, who is kind of a
comic book legend. Mage and Grendel were his big independent ones, but he also very notably drew a great Legends of the Dark Knight three-parter called Faces way back in when that Legends of the Dark Knight first started
Trinity.
In the 90s. That's right.
But this one is all sort of about the relationship between Bruce Wayne and Dick Grayson. It kind of flashes back to the night Dick Grayson's parents were killed and sort of kind of putting together the mindset of what Dick Grayson was feeling then with sort of the out-of-control nature of it as opposed to how Bruce feels right now being sort of left at the altar and kind of lost.
It's interesting.
And sort of putting those two pieces together and kind of examining them all through sort of the different ways these characters view each other, because Dick Grayson is definitely more upbeat, even regardless of what he's been through. He's always been sort of the he has the ability to joke and laugh and sort of deal with pain.
He should be like, Batman, lighten up.
I mean, it doesn't say that expressly, but it's definitely kind of putting those two psyches together on like what makes them different.
Tom King, I think, likes to do sort of mine those kind of similarities and differences and then play around a little bit with time and juxtapose things to just kind of heighten similarities and differences. So that it makes sense. But it is a story I don't think I've seen particularly told.
Yeah. And they're dealing with the villains. Like, I mean, you could say they're joke villains like Crazy Quilt and Condiment King.
Yep.
But you know, they're played pretty well. They're not like a completely set out for laughs.
Did he turn Condiment King into a serial killer?
Yes,
he does. He did actually mention him murdering three people.
Yeah, he does.
Just checking. I was curious to know what if the direction he went with was kind of like super goofy, or they're goofy but dangerous.
Nightwing is poking fun. He's like, I can't believe we're actually taking this seriously. And Batman's like, he killed three people.
I think he's been robbing grocery stores. Like, you know,
did he like pour Taco Bell hot sauce packets down their throat?
I think probably he murdered them with ketchup, which is darker than it sounds.
Yeah, if you drown somebody in ketchup, that would be kind of creepy. That's just creepy.
I'd be like, delicious, blah.
But yeah, ultimately it is all about the sort of relationship. And Wagner does a great job with the art. Yeah, it's just another good issue. I think I'm just on board Tom King until he finishes his 100. And you're probably going to hear a bunch more picks.
At least 46 more, perhaps?
Yes, 46 more picks, probably.
Is this a standalone issue, or is it part of a larger story?
It's a standalone issue, although I've heard because of it, I think some big things are going to start happening in Nightwing. I don't know exactly what that means, but that is what I've heard.
All right.
Dave, what is your backup pick?
My backup pick is something that was not on my radar at all. A Silver Surfer annual. Now, you guys can correct me if I'm wrong, but is there a Silver Surfer comic going on right now?
No, there's not.
No, there's not.
I didn't think so.
The most recent one was the Dan Slott stuff.
Right.
I feel like
I know that went farther than I thought, but yeah. I believe it did end in some months ago at the very least.
I think it ended a little longer than that.
Yeah, like it could have been like a year ago or something.
But yes.
And I don't know if this was just, like, some story on file or just taking a while because it was an annual and it took a while to draw. I did like the art style on it a lot. But it was it's a very satisfying standalone story that starts with kind of the early days of Silver Surfer, Norrin Rad as a kid on, Zen Law?
Yeah.
And, you see a little glimpse of a not super happy childhood for him, but the big story is that he arrives on this planet, and they show that he does try, of course, to... This is during the heyday of him working for Galactus. He has not met the FF or anything
yet. But
finding planets to kill. That's his job. And what he does, though, is try to find uninhabited planets, but it's clear that can only last for so long because Galactus needs the full energy of an inhabited planet. And what he finds is this insectoid world where there's like brutal warfare going on up above, and it's pretty horrific. He says it would almost be a mercy to the universe to wipe them out before they find a way to infest other worlds. And so he's like going to reluctantly, if you think about it, it's like in Kill or Be Killed, the guy's like, well, if I have to murder somebody for this demon, I'll try and murder bad people. Well, that's kind of what Silver Surfer's doing, but he's like, well, I'll only murder bad worlds.
Bad planets.
Yeah, but they've all bad.
I really like the emotion that this artist is able to get on Silver Surfer's face.
Yeah, and ultimately this is an emotional story. I don't want to reveal too much because it has some interesting twists and turns. But he does discover, first of all, there's a threat level that's higher than he expected from these aliens. And there's also a secret from below the planet that reveals something. And throughout it's like, you know, you will get to see the Silver Surfer stuff. I feel like this is what people want in Silver Surfer. It's like, it's kind of what I want. It's got a kind of a deeper story to it, some philosophical leanings to it. He gets to blast stuff. He's getting in a tough fight. He hits things with his board. but in its heart, it's an emotional story. And because, you know, he's like this warrior poet type guy. You know, he's a soulful dude for a guy who's as powerful as he is.
Yeah.
And this story they have something interesting to say in this story that's a pretty emotional thing and ends on a pretty powerful note, I think.
Yeah.
So
there's a backup at the last page from both the writer and artist. Oh, I guess the artist, the artist is like, this is dedicated to Mobius. His light will inspire us forever.
I can see that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just flipping through the art, and it is very Mobius in style.
That makes sense. He's there. There's this scene, this great scene, and I don't know, it could even be a specific homage to a scene that Mobius did in his graphic novel with Stan Lee.
The Parable?
Yeah.
I think that's what this artist mentions.
Where Surfer, if you think of the cameras being here, the camera is right at the level of, like, the rings on a giant ringed world like Saturn, and the Silver Surfer is like surfing across them and just skimming them as if they were waves, and it looks really cool. The perspective is really deep, and I was like, oh, that does seem like something that Mobius would kind of do. This artist also reminded me a little bit of Frank Quitely and those other Quitely guys like Aaron Kuder and stuff, and for sure in a good way. Anyway. I know there's lots of Silver Surfer fans, and I feel like sometimes, like, I like Dan Slott's run, but it was a very Doctor Who spin on it.
Yeah.
And I felt like sometimes I'm like, yeah, this isn't giving people quite what they want. I feel like this one does.
This is a very classic Silver Surfer. Like, if there was more, if this is the first issue of a Silver Surfer series, like, I'd be into it. I really like this.
Yeah, same, obviously. What else? Yeah.
All right. My backup is a book I talked about, I think, the first issue that I never really got back to, but I've been reading it. It's The Dead Hand, number 6. Yep. This is the Image book that was about a sort of a Cold War spy who was now living in some sort of isolated Soviet mountain town that was trying to pretend it was the 1950s.
Yeah.
Well, 6 issues in, they have explained what the whole thing is. It has to do with artificial intelligence and a fail-safe program. And
it is a very heightened level of spy stuff.
Yeah, ex-spies.
I mean, it's the kind of thing you could almost find in a Marvel comic, but it's taken out of the context of a superhero world, but it has that kind of largeness in a way.
Yeah, it's definitely more spy-y than
superhero. It's more serious than you would get.
It's James Bondian. It's Bondian at its best. But it's so a variety of ex-spies and retired spies have sort of come together in this town over this sort of artificial intelligence. And this issue wraps that whole thing. It also has really, really nice artwork. The artist is Stephen Mooney, and it's got this sort of gritty vibe. It looks like somebody who would work with Ed Brubaker or Greg Rucka.
Yeah, I remember reading the first issue or two and feeling sort of that Brubaker vibe, like from his cap or something.
And so this issue sort of brings all that to a head with a surprising contribution from the one of the younger characters, and has what says the end. But it also, they're putting out a trade that is Volume 1, so I don't know if they're going to go on from here or if this is a complete story, but at any rate, it wraps up well, and when the Dead Hand trade comes out in a week or two, I would definitely, or I guess, yeah, it comes out in October, I would definitely point people in that direction. I actually really like this. Also on my list this week, Immortal Hulk number 5, which has a throwdown between Hulk and Sasquatch, and a big reveal about what's been going on with this sort of mysterious spiritual foe, and some big reveals there.
Joe Bennett is killing it.
Yeah, the art's great. X-Men Gold number 35 is the penultimate issue. It is a big thing with Storm and her past in Africa. Venom First Host number 2. This is the weekly Venom series that's going. And it basically is Venom meets a Kree who used to have the Venom symbiote and ties into some of the cosmic stuff. They mentioned Venom Space Knight. It's an interesting and different Venom story. And then Outpost Zero number 3, which is the third issue of Sean McKeever and Alexandre Tefengi?
Sure.
Their story of a lost colony in this snow planet and what is sort of they describe as the most distant small town in the world or something like that. but worth a read. Dave, what else you got?
Let's see. I wanted to mention a series I continue to really enjoy, the book Unnatural from Image. The kind of anthropomorphic, it would almost seem like a slice of life, but it's also kind of speculative fiction and it's sort of what might be an alternate present. So this is the one where, when I say anthropomorphic, the lead character is like a pig woman. That sounds, can't help but come out harsh, but it's just like she's got a little piggy upturned nose. This is a European comic and has kind of some of the cheesecake style that they do. She's like in her mid-20s and looking for love, and there's a big thing in this comic about sort of a clear-cut metaphor for like, I'm going to say like interracial dating and any sort of, anything that's sort of would be, by like 1950 standards, be considered outside the norm, because that is not acceptable on her planet. She has these dreams of getting together with this like wolf guy, but that would be completely unacceptable. And there's... in fact, when you hit age 25, if you have not found a suitable mate, it's like you go to this government center and they begin what seems like it's a kind of nice, almost okay Cupid, but like on a much larger scale version, where they'll get you all dressed up for your date, and they'll run all the data files and find you the perfect guy for you or girl or whatever. Also, by the way, no dating out, you know, it's the same sex. Nothing like that. Unfortunately, her best friend is gay, so that's problematic. Here she's kind of... Right now she's being a little bit swept up along in events that are beyond her, and she's kind of like, well, I'll try it. Okay, I don't want to do this, but yeah. And then things sort of seem to be going surprisingly well with what they're showing her today, or showing that date. But there's something creepy lurking in the background, and meanwhile, her friend is looking into this almost like this mythic legend that has to that might connect to her. And I'm wondering, is this? It feels like the book, despite being relatively real, despite the visual style, you know, in the same way that Usagi Yojimbo is relatively realistic. Like, if there may be something supernatural or almost some kind of weird cabin in the woods-ish thing, where it's almost like there could be, like, some of the people behind the programming the world to work the way it does in that really strict, racist way, that there almost could be some cult-like thing behind it. But I'm not sure if it's that or those were just, like, dreamlike elements. But anyway, the book has more going on than being a cheesecake book about a pig woman.
Sure.
and I really like it. It's kind of slice of life, and but it's kind of cutesy-sexy, too. I didn't get around to reading it, but there's a book or a new ongoing series, I think, called James Bond Origin.
I think it's just a mini-series.
Yeah, it's all the James Bond.
I can swear I saw it said ongoing. When I was making the sign, but
like the book about Elric, it will last 100 issues.
Yes, and this seems to be like the Bond of the books, who operated in like the 50s and 60s. It's using that timeline because as a young man, or like in his like I don't know mid or late teens or something like that, he is there when the Blitz happens during World War II and kind of has to use his wits to survive, and you kind of see these elements that will become the later Bond in there. It is not quite your hackneyed James Bond Jr. cartoon, but it does show kind of like how he found his leanings to become the man he was. And Jeff Parker, has he been writing some of the other Bond stuff?
I don't know, actually.
He seems like a good fit for it in general, and I haven't read it yet, but it sounded interesting, and I'm curious to check it out. The last thing I want to mention is when Free Comic Book Day happened, they had a preview copy of a comic that began in the 90s called Berlin by the writer and artist Jason Lutz, and it's about the rise of fascism in Germany in the 30s. Sounds all serious. It is pretty serious, but it's also darkly funny at times, and a really good slice of life of kind of about the artists and politicians and normal people living in Germany, including there was like that bohemian culture that had popped up then. Anybody's ever seen the movie Cabaret? Have you seen that, Nick?
Yeah,
it's there's elements of that in there too, and that culture trying to come to terms with fascism as it slowly approaches, because it doesn't happen overnight. Now, again, as I said when I was complimenting the Free Comic Book Day one, I don't know why they chose to release this beautiful hardcover of this story right now.
I'm puzzled.
I'm not sure what bearing it has on modern events, on how it would be maybe about our short-sightedness to see what's happening right all around us. But beyond all that, this is a very beautifully drawn, very well-written, deep character study, and I've never read the full thing, so I'm super looking forward to reading the whole thing. It's a pretty massive achievement. This is, you know, I mean, I hate to compare it to something that seems so gloomy, but it seems like it could be on the order of Mouse, you know, Art Spiegelman's Pulitzer Prize winning comic. Maybe I'll report back in the next week or two after having read it. But that's all I got. Nick, what do you got?
A few more. The third issue of Captain America, which sees Steve team up with T'Challa to infiltrate a nuke base. Brian Michael Bendis has a new book called Cover, teaming up with his friend David Mack, about a...
This seems like a very egotistical premise, but it's still kind of fun.
Yeah, it's about a writer-artist being
He's got international... He travels around internationally or whatever, right?
Yeah, and he's being sort of approached by a government official to become sort of a spy.
Yep.
It is a little kind of egotistical at times, but I think the execution is actually really well done.
To be fair, I did ask you, because I haven't read this yet, like, does the guy, like, look like Bendis or anything?
No,
like,
it does not. And I have to say, David Mack's artwork, he gets to sort of stretch his legs and kind of not only do his painterly style, but also sort of a more minimalistic kind of...
Yeah.
That style.
That looks really nice.
Yeah, it's great. So
actually, his character work reminds me of, like, almost like some of the stuff from Iron Fist. Who was that artist? David Aja?
Yeah, Aja.
Just reminded me a little bit of him.
Second issue of The Adventures of Super Sons, the 12-issue maxi-series from Peter Tomasi.
We keep selling out of that. We reorder it, we sell out, we reorder, we sell out.
I mean, it's a lot of fun, and this opening story is about a group of alien individuals who grew up on Earth Adventures that have been beamed to their planet. So they took on the personalities of all the villains and are going after... Damian and Jonathan.
It's like a skewed version of Galaxy Quest.
A little bit. And there's some twists and turns. It's just fun. And then there's a new book called As Guardians of the Galaxy from Colin Bunn and Matteo Lolli, which sees a... since the Guardians of the Galaxy are kind of pushed out or slash murdered...
But yeah, we weren't quite sure.
...from Infinity Wars, a new group is sort of taking over... it's a group run by Hela, or no, not Hela,
Angela.
Angela, sorry.
Thor's sister.
Yes, Thor's sister.
Hela is also Thor's sister.
Is she?
In the movies.
In the movies, not in the, but that's what confused me.
Not in the comics yet.
It is Angela and, a destroyer armor.
Yep.
Sort of gathering up a new team filled with people like Scourge, weirdly, Thunderstrike.
Who the hell is that Thunderstrike?
It's not Eric Masterson,
no,
is it?
No, it's some weird goofy dude. I don't know anything. They did not introduce the character in here. Like, I feel like he must be around somewhere.
Okay, maybe in Exiles or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is very weird. There's also Valkyrie, but she's got a weird new sharing a body with a human, which feels very kind of classic Thor in some ways.
Yep, right.
And there's also Throg.
Yes.
Because, you know, because every Guardians of the Galaxy team needs, like, a some little beast to kill.
I hadn't made the connection that he was their rocket, but that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. It's a fun adventure. It's opening up, a whole can of worms about, you know, a big bad sort of taking over. It's definitely worth your attention if you like any of those characters or kind of want something... to fill in the gaps of Guardians of the Galaxy.
If you wanted to see a bunch of Asgardians in one place whooping up.
Yeah, that was a good call.
Well, I thought it was interesting. In the back, Cullen Bunn writes about, like, he'd been wanting this book for a long time, mm-hmm. that he had pitched it as, like, a Thor book, basically. Mm-hmm. You know, it's inspired by, like, what he liked about Walt Simonson's Thor. It is basically an Asgard team book, and I think the Asgardians of the Galaxy became, like, the pitch for it. But this is less of a Guardians of the Galaxy replacement and more of a, like, Asgardians in Space adventure book. I think if people liked Ragnarok and that kind of thing,
right.
This would be in the vein you might want to check out.
And then my last trio of books are all written by one guy. it has become Donnie Cates Wednesday.
I did not realize that.
He has the third issue of Cosmic Ghost Rider, which continues to see Crazy Frank Castle, who has stolen baby Thanos and trying to raise him to not be a murderous...
maybe baby Thanos can finally get the attention he needs.
I mean, as you might imagine, it doesn't go very well. He has the third issue of Death of Inhumans, which the body count is getting less. And also this one...
how many puppers did they kill today?
They did not kill any puppers, but the puppers' death actually makes an inhuman ally join the cause, and it is kind of an awesome thing. So I'm
worth
curious.
Killing a pupper?
No, nothing is worth that.
By the way, I feel sure that if there is any death that will not stick, even more than Black Bolt, Lockjaw will be back.
Well, also, Black Bolt is not dead.
Son of a bitch.
And he gets to be kind of awesome in this one. Okay. This is sort of more of Donny Cates. I'm not killing anybody. I'm just making some of the Inhumans be pretty damn cool,
if
which
I could,
I'm happy about.
If I could just see Black Bolt say, "Where's my dog?" and decimate a city doing it, then I'd be happy.
Well, I mean, he does detonate a person's head because of it. Is that... That's starting.
I need a city.
You need a city.
Yeah.
And then Donny Cates has a new book, Thanos Legacy, which is a sequel to his Thanos Wins story, sort of continuing on where that left off. It is basically two different stories. One sort of about that, and then one about his relationship with Gamora, which is actually an all-silent story, which I thought was pretty cool. So, yeah. Now... That is all that I have on my pile. All
right. So we're going to be back in just a second to talk about a TV show and a podcast.
Talking about comics, movies, and fame. They even talk about board games. No week is the same.
Nick, you have podcast news for us once
again. I do. This comes from a recommendation from one of our customers, Jim Mitchell. He told me about a podcast called And That's Why We Drink, which I guess he was quite addicted to. It is two women who get together. One is a true crime aficionado. Uh-huh. The other one is a supernatural aficionado. So they basically get together and each tell one story of supernatural stuff and uh-huh. one about a true crime.
Interesting.
I seem to
become aware of a number of true crime podcasts.
Yeah, lately. I mean, it's a huge crazy. I think that comes along with the sort of television aspect because Netflix does all their true crime. They have some big ones like The Staircase that just hit, mm-hmm. and then what was their true crime thing that kind of hit crazy bonkers numbers that Netflix did?
Making a Murder.
Yeah, yeah. Making a Murder. Yeah. And then, of course, the Serial and all that other, those podcasts sort of kind
right.
of. And yeah, people just
and
jump on true
in the
crime.
Background, there's stuff like, what's the Mindhunter, you know,
yeah.
on Netflix. So yeah.
And then the supernatural stuff is sort of where, what kind of got me, because uh-huh. I like the horror a little bit more than true crime, because true crime is scary as hell,
sure,
in my opinion,
sure.
especially some of the stories.
What I have
they get
noticed
into.
Is that there's a lot of the podcasts that I've listened to about them. I haven't quite stayed with any of them, but I'll occasionally check one out. Darkly Funny.
Yeah.
The podcasters go kind of very darkly funny.
And that's
them.
Sort of what this is. One and they kind of, you know, they one person. And it's called And That's Why We Drink. One person drinks wine, whatever wine they have, be it boxed wine because she's broke that week, or, you know, whatever. And the
and
other one...
Patreon people hooking them up with good wine.
And the other one exclusively drinks milkshakes. And she goes on to, you know, whatever she's drinking, be it a shake from McDonald's, a Shamrock shake from McDonald's, or... they've talked about a $50 the best of the best milkshake that she wants to try. She also does like prop making for a lot of television shows. So she's sort of in the business. This is, takes place, or they, I guess, record out of LA.
Okay.
But yeah, no, the stories are actually very well, you know, referenced.
Do you feel like they are they being extemporaneous, or are they like reading kind of like a script?
No, it's definitely sort of like we are doing, like sitting around the table. They definitely
that
have researched.
Cool, huh?
They've researched.
That one's supposed to be funny.
They've researched whatever they're there to talk about, but they kind of feed off of each other as well, which
sure,
I think
sure.
is perfect. But they've talked about like the Amityville Horror, and they went into sort of like what's supposed to be the real thing, but also sort of all the other stuff. Which,
what about the Enfield Poltergeist?
I don't know if they have not gotten there.
That was the basis for Conjuring, too.
Right.
But also Ghostwatch.
Look at Dave and all his ghost knowledge.
Well, I mean, I expect that from Dave.
He does have a PhD in ghost knowledge. That's right.
But yeah.
Plus, that makes me feel good.
But yeah, I don't even know how to continue on with
sorry,
that.
Sorry, I didn't mean to derail your conversation inanity. So, Nick, tell me, how long does the podcast run?
They usually run about 45 minutes to an hour.
And that's with both the stories
factored in? Both stories. Yeah, like one of them was about the Winchester House, mm-hmm. which I actually thought was really, really interesting to hear. Sort of a more down-to-earth compared to the movie that we got, which was a little schlocky at times.
Yeah, I heard it was not great.
And, you know, and then, of course, talking about, like, real-life murder cases, like Jim Jones and sort of his cult that he did and sort of some of the... things that actually happened in that I knew nothing about because
there's a lot of murder in podcasts, isn't there?
There really is. Well, the Jim Jones.
The other big ones are the My Favorite Murderer and Last Podcast on the Left.
Yeah.
And I know that there's several
and Serial,
I'm missing. Yeah.
Nest Town.
Yeah.
There's one about like the Annabelle doll.
I will say some of the TV that has interested me in the last few years has been somewhat like crime and intrigue related true stories, like the O.J. Simpson one, which mm-hmm. was that.
Yeah.
What was that called?
People vs. O.J. Simpson.
People vs. O.J. Simpson.
Yep.
And just recently, The Looming Tower, which, not crime per se, but kind of more, that's where we're almost more.
Kind of a big crime.
Crime. I tend to think of it more as espionage, intrigue, terrorism type of stuff, but yes. Maybe we should use that as the lead into where we're headed next. But anyway, but it is fascinating to see explored in a greater way, like. Sometimes you're aware of these things in the news. Like, I lived through the Menendez brothers and some of these other famous cases. But I kind of... They all sort of slipped away and became pop culture to me.
Dave, I would just like to point out for everyone listening, there's a bit of phrasing there, like, I lived through the Menendez brothers, but they seem to have slipped away. Sounds like they were haunting you. you managed to get away from them, and then they slipped into the night. Which I like. Oh, was that you were talking about different Menendez brothers?
Yeah, that's Todd and Steve Menendez.
Yes. Dave's actually never heard of the actual case. He's like, well, I remember when I slipped away from the Menendez brothers, and they slipped away.
Those are some guys. They were trying to make me pick up their bar tab, and I was like, I'm not having it. And I slipped away. but anyway, my broader point, and I did have one, is that there is something about taking these things that we think are familiar, but that we really usually don't know many of the details about, and I think. That's what these podcasts dive into.
Yeah, even like the Watergate podcast.
The Slow Burn.
Yeah. Super interesting.
Basically takes something everyone knows at least can recognize the immediate fact.
Right.
But then
the way you think about Watergate is like, oh yeah, there was like nobody knew anything, and then Woodward and Bernstein found out about the stuff, and then it was over.
And that was like just like a minor thing.
And they're like, booking boys.
Yeah.
And I'm like, no, not even remotely.
Yeah.
So this podcast really kind of intrigued me, and basically the way it's presented is
comboing
sort
up
of,
horror kind of super spooky stuff with true crime is a pretty clever idea.
Yeah. I'm really enjoying it.
I don't know how I feel about the milkshakes, but everything else seems cool.
Milkshakes are amazing. What the hell are you talking about?
They sometimes make my tummy rumbly. That's what the hell I'm talking about,
but,
Nick.
But don't you enjoy it while you're drinking it? You might regret it later, but...
Yes, I do.
That's a problem for later day.
Yes.
Or future
day. If our store Patreon, which we have, right?
Yeah, sure.
If they could hook me up with one of those peanut butter chocolate shakes from Alamo, that'd be fantastic.
That's true. Those are pretty good.
The other thing I want to talk about was a show that Nick and I have both watched, and I think Dave hasn't only because Dave is...
I'm primeless. I'm Amazon primeless.
Yeah.
I'm an Amazon primitive.
I was going to say you have, at best, a casual relationship with television.
Yes, that's true. But I am interested in this one, and I will probably try and make a point to get in on it.
I, of course, am married to television.
Yep.
And Nick is dating pretty heavily.
Yeah, I'm dating pretty heavily.
So the show is Jack Ryan on Amazon. It is John Krasinski in the lead role as Jack Ryan, and Wendell Pierce as...
Yep.
Greer. Jim Greer, although he's not an admiral in this one, right?
No, he's not. He's basically...
Greer, who we know, by the way, from the better movies as James Earl Jones played him.
Yeah, he's basically... getting his appointment to the head of this analyst group because he screwed up.
Yeah, something happened and he winds up sort of disgraced, but at the head of this smaller group at the CIA where Jack Ryan is an analyst. And he in the first episode, meets a young woman named Kathy Mueller, who's a doctor, who we all know as fans of the books, he's going to wind up marrying.
Yeah, I like that this is sort of a reimagining of the Jack Ryan book series.
Well, because Jack Ryan was a Vietnam vet.
I don't know about his military service. I kind of,
because he was supposed to be in a helicopter accident that he was the lone survivor of, which they did keep.
They changed it up, and it's actually a pretty notable story. You'll get to it later.
Yeah,
because they're hinting.
I also don't remember at least what little they showed the books may have shown more. I don't remember Greer having ever been disgraced or that was any notable part of his story.
Yeah, they're definitely making some changes, and also. This opens with an airstrike in Beirut in 1983 that informs the villain.
Is it Beirut
of
or is it Bosnia?
It's Beirut.
Okay.
Yeah, it's Beirut.
Okay.
And
It's like sets in motion the events.
It sets in motion, like 35 years ago, this happened. And,
was the deal where there's like high civilian casualties or something like that?
Yeah,
or
is like it is like a pair of younger brothers who their house gets bombed,
right.
And they will grow up to be terrorists.
Right.
And then Jack is working at the CIA as an analyst and gets drawn out into field work, where, of course, he fits in reasonably well because he was a Marine.
Right.
He is equipped for field work. He just doesn't really want to be a field agent.
Right.
Meanwhile, there's all this stuff going on with the relationship with his new girlfriend, or not really even girlfriend, just sort of someone he's interested in.
Yeah.
And there's this big terrorist plot. This feels to me like a more nuanced 24.
Yeah.
They definitely go a lot into the Mideastern politics. There is also a drone pilot that shows up, and they get into the politics of drone strikes and
wasn't quite sure where
PTSD
that thread was going
and that kind of thing. So, it's got multiple layers. It feels a lot like what I liked about the Jack Ryan movies.
Yeah. One of the things that, having not seen this, one of the things I liked about those is like the tech side of things.
Yeah.
So whether it was like finding out about like how like, you know, stealth submarine technology might work, or seeing how, you know, like essentially a special ops team uses those little micro cameras on the little wire sort of things where they can bend them under doors and stuff, or especially super notable, the satellite scene where they take out the terrorist camp in Patriot Games.
There's some references to those.
Do we see any glimpse of kind of like the kind of cool tech stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I would say it's not as
heavy.
It sounds like they're not starting out at the place where Jack Ryan will end up.
Right.
No, but it feels very Clancy-ish to me.
Okay.
I mean, basically an execution, and I actually think Krasinski does a great Jack Ryan.
Krasinski's great in this.
I like his analyst side, mm-hmm. And his...
This guy from... recently from Quiet Place, yeah. And then
and
obviously
The
Office, yeah.
Well, I like how basically the first episode is sort of all about him behind the desk, and they quickly get him out into the field, and sort of seeing him in the field is interesting.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I don't want to get too much because I don't want to spoil anything, but there are some cool...
But they jump around quite a bit. Like, they do a variety of settings all over the world. They go to different places. You explore sort of what it's like to be an operative in these kind of places. I was a little worried it was going to be kind of jingoistic right wing. And it's got a little... I mean, that's sort of built into any kind of military espionage.
Yeah.
But I think they do a good job of sort of presenting all sides and sort of...
I think the villains are extremely nuanced for being villains.
They're also, they're also good bad guys, and also the action is good. Like, the basics of this are solid.
That's what I was going to ask, is like, you know, how's the suspense elements or action elements?
I mean, there's a big...
there's a big shootout at the end of the first episode.
Yeah, there's a big action scene towards the end of that, and it's very well done.
I have a fondness for like really well-staged action that feels realistic, even if it might not be completely realistic.
Right.
Michael Mann is always one of my go-to directors on this. The heat shootout, the end shootout, or several of the incidents in Miami Vice are really well-staged.
Yeah.
And the original the Ryan movies were known for some great action sequences as well.
Who's doing this? Like, showrunning? Is anybody notable?
I don't remember who's doing it.
Todd
Menendez, after he escaped Dave. I don't remember who. That would have been a good thing to look up before we started doing this.
By the way, can y'all tell me, like, how long is the season?
Eight episodes.
Okay. Yeah.
Which I like a good 8-episode show.
Of course. It's Carlton Cuse.
And Graham Rowland, that's right.
Yeah, it's notable.
Graham Rowland did Fringe and Almost Human. Carlton Cuse did Lost and a ton of other stuff.
I guess Clancy is...
Are you going to botch the ending like they botched the ending of Lost? That's just... I just threw that in because it had to be ubiquitous.
Sure.
Somebody had to say it.
It's Clancy... Yeah, Clancy is involved in some of the writing, too, so that would make a little sense.
Is he?
Yeah.
I mean, he's
is he involved the way he's involved in his, like, massive empire of games?
Yeah,
and books?
I think that's the thing. I don't think he's writing anything. I think he's
just,
like...
Well, they did give him a credit.
They credit him as a good producer, because it's all sourced on his material. But I don't know how involved he is in the actual day-to-day.
Yeah.
I definitely recommend this to people. I think it's worth a look. All right. That'll wrap it up for us this week. We'll be back next week with more. Until that time...
Yo, Joe!
Thanks for listening. If you like the show, do us a favor and spread the word to your friends. Or give us a quick 5-star rating and review on iTunes to help us grow our audience. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or at www.roguesgallerytx.com. We'll be back next week.